Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view into challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. I'm at a music festival in Cumberland, Maryland this weekend, hence the background noise you might be hearing during the narration. You know, I've got to address the most recent mass shootings, as well as shootings en masse, in light of the Tops grocery store massacre in Buffalo, New York, and now the elementary school killings in Texas. We don't know much about the latest shooter other than that he was 18 and owned two AR-15s, the assault-style rifles, which he purchased legally just months ago. He shot his own grandmother in the face before driving a few blocks away to the nearby elementary school, where he crashed his truck and then entered the building, gaining access to a classroom, whereupon he killed 19 students and two teachers before a police officer killed him. No racist, xenophobic, Tucker Carlson, Alex Jones-like manifesto has been found yet, unlike the Buffalo shooter, who is also a youth, but a white guy with a head full of toxic ideology. He left a manifesto, a virtual novella, that parroted the usual Fox News dogma about immigrants and black folks conspiring to replace Caucasians for political purposes. In his case, racism and white fragility, combined with toxic masculinity, gained expression through guns pointed at random shoppers at the only grocery store in a predominantly black neighborhood. Like Dylan Roof or the mass shooter in El Paso, or Tucker Carlson or the Tiki Nazis in Charlottesville, these are white supremacists whose core beliefs frame non-white people as a mortal enemy to be deported, segregated, subjugated, or killed. It doesn't matter if they're actually violent or how outspoken they are or whether they're full-blown racial fascists or just a little bit racist. These ideologies exist on a continuum. Like COVID, whether you're on your way to meet your demise with a respirator tube jammed down your throat at an overcrowded hospital or going to a grocery unmasked with just a mild case of the COVID sniffles, you are infected. It's time we treat racism, xenophobia, homophobia, transphobia, and misogyny the same way. Educate actively to prevent it, isolate it when it shows up, quarantine those with really bad cases, and criminalize its intentional proliferation by known carriers. Free speech be damned, it should be illegal to gather in numbers to menace a community while chanting anti-Semitic slogans, or to profile or harass black people on the streets in their own neighborhood under the guise of a badge, or to mistreat unsanctioned immigrants escaping intolerable economic or political or climactic conditions that we created in their home countries in the South or Africa or Asia or the Middle East. Judging by current polls that show nearly a third of all Americans believe in the so-called Great Replacement Theory promoted by Fox's Tucker Carlson or Alex Jones or any of the white supremacist broadcasters, it should seem that there are more people infected with racism than there are people of color committing crimes of any kind, let alone participating in some kind of eugenic plot to get the upper hand over whitey by sheer numbers. Free speech is not and has never been an absolute. We limit it in many places. Suddenly, America is remembering the comic genius George Carlin, who, with the help of this radio network, pursued a free speech case all the way to the Supreme Court, which ruled to curtail free speech by allowing the FCC to ban a short list of words from the public airwaves. We don't allow people to make public threats of violence against individuals or groups or federal employees, although obviously the laws that criminalize that behavior are selectively enforced. If you're wearing a neo-Nazi symbol on your vest and carrying an AR-15 and standing on the statehouse steps with a bullhorn, you can bark about mass civil rights violations with impunity, it seems. Or you can sit in your mother's basement tapping away on your computer, polluting social media chat rooms like 4chan with messages of hate and violence, or even plot to kidnap a governor. And while you may be being watched, chances are nothing will happen. No action will be taken against you. You can even commit a physical crime against somebody based on your racist or misogynist motivations, and your history of hate spewing will only become a factor in your sentencing if the prosecutors bring it up and press it as a hate crime. Unless, of course, you're a police officer or border patrol or ICE agent, in which case you're more likely than not to get away with it anyway. All of which brings us to guns. Again, nearly a third of Americans believe that people of color are conspiring to replace the current white majority with some sinister political purpose. Jeffrey Epstein sold the sexual services of underage girls to a whole retinue of prominent politicians and celebrities and power brokers, including policymakers who spoke out against child prostitution and human trafficking. The Southern Baptist Convention not only covered up and abetted sexual abuse by its male officers for decades, much like the Catholic Church, but even adopted a tenet in its platform that says that women should obey their husbands. The Supreme Court is about to eliminate women's equality by overturning Roe v. Wade. Discrimination against non-heterosexual people in commerce has been affirmed. Immigrants and asylum seekers are being incarcerated and tortured. Republican candidates who are winning their primaries or are already elected are calling for the limiting of civil rights of entire classes of people. Some were even active participants in the January 6th attempted insurrection and coup, and who marched therefore under a Confederate flag and passed the mock gallows erected on the Capitol lawn. Meanwhile, Tucker Carlson, the nation's most popular television broadcaster, claims that the Buffalo shooter's motivations were not political. Kind of like saying the Ku Klux Klan or the Republican Party aren't racist. It would be nice to dismiss that garbage by saying no one believes it, but apparently a full third of people do. Does this sound like the sort of cultural conditions that would make mass gun ownership a safe and benign thing? So if every mass shooter is, as the Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott stated this week, suffering from a mental illness, doesn't it stand to reason that the mental illness as a condition preceded the shooting? Or does the mental illness only manifest when the would-be killer's finger is on the semi-automatic trigger? And if you buy the gun proliferationist's argument that more should be done to treat mental illness, though I have yet to see gun clubs or the NRA rallying to support mental health service bills or levies, then shouldn't we be treating racism, sexism, xenophobia, and the like as mental illnesses? And if you take just the minimal step beyond where most gun proliferation activists are willing to go and compromise and say that people who do suffer from mental illnesses should be prevented from owning firearms, then the would-be shooters and the tiki Nazis and the social media trolls might be less of a threat, right? But America isn't going there. Indeed, we're heading in the opposite direction. The Republican-dominated Ohio legislature just eliminated most pre-qualifying conditions for owning a gun and made it legal to carry one concealed in any situation. They want to make it illegal for businesses and institutions like universities to prohibit guns on their premises. In this first segment, we'll hear from scholar Steve Hostetler, debunking many of the gun proliferation advocates' arguments in a kind of rapid-fire monologue. Then we'll hear from economist Richard Wolff, debunking another set of myths about inflation. Here's Steve Hostetler.
And now, here are answers for every argument against gun control in one video. I have a stand-up clip where I talk about gun control, and every time I post it, I get the same 24 asinine responses. Here goes. Number one. There should be no gun control at all. Okay, if you think there should be absolutely no laws when it comes to the regulation of firearms, that means it shouldn't be child endangerment to give one to a toddler. Arm the toddlers, like the Bill of Rights intended. But let's say you are one of the crazies who thinks that a 2-year-old operating a firearm is perfectly fine. How about a recently paroled murderous sex offender who moves right next door to your daughter? Should that guy be allowed to own a gun? If you think that there should be exceptions for either of these or any other examples, then you admit that we should be able to reinterpret the Second Amendment for the time that we are currently living in. Number two. The Constitution is absolute. No, it absolutely isn't. You know how I know? Because that is what an amendment is. It is the Constitution being amended. 27 times the United States has seen fit to fix something that the Constitution either left out or got completely wrong. In fact, the 18th Amendment was prohibition, and that was repealed by the 21st Amendment. But to get a bit more into the weeds, the first 10 amendments are commonly known as the Bill of Rights. That document was greatly influenced by one that preceded it by 2 years, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen. If you haven't heard of that, that's because it's not an American document. It is a French Revolution document drawn up by Lafayette. and Thomas Jefferson. The basic concept is that we all have unlimited rights until those rights infringe on the rights of someone else. And if you've never read or even heard of the document that the Bill of Rights is based on, I'm not going to accept your self-appointed expertise. Number 3. Why would we make it tougher for responsible people to own a gun? Because then it would also be harder for irresponsible people to own one. What a lot of anti-gun control people don't realize is the vast majority of the left doesn't actually want to get rid of guns. What we want is people who own them to be educated and responsible. Let's say you're in a situation with one of those good guys with a gun I always hear so much about, and I'll get to that fallacy later. You're just out shopping when suddenly a gun-wielding maniac grabs you. Thankfully, a good guy with a gun steps forward. Now, before that guy shoots, do you hope that he learned how to aim? So do I. Think of gun regulations like locking your door. Why bother to lock it when someone could still just smash your window? You lock your door because any deterrent, no matter how small, reduces the likelihood of a crime. Also, making it harder to own a gun actually rewards responsible gun owners by making it more of an exclusive club. You're welcome. Number 4. You're already required to register guns. Except you're not. See, you're required to register some guns in some places. But 42 states, and we have 50 of those, by the way, do not require mandatory registration. But if you did register your gun and you think that that's fine, well then you should support other people registering theirs as well. One more thing. We have no border checkpoints between states, so registration is pointless unless it is a federal, searchable registry. And we don't have that. Number 5. Gun registration leads directly to confiscation. What a hilariously untrue statement. Let's start with Canada. In 1995, Canada passed the Firearms Act, mandating registration. Yet Canada still has the 8th most guns per capita of any country at 34.7%. The people who say that Canada confiscates guns are either wrong or lying. Even with a new strict proposed bill that has not yet passed, buyback is still voluntary. Finland has a gun registry, and they're at 32.4% guns per capita. Australia, the United Kingdom, Bangladesh, Costa Rica, Iceland. There are over 100 countries that require owners to register guns that haven't confiscated them. Have any regimes confiscated guns? Sure, but people also fuck sandwiches. I'll explain. Gun registration can lead to confiscation, the same way that making a sandwich can lead to sticking your dick in a grilled cheese. It is possible, but to argue that it's inevitable shows a complete misunderstanding of statistics. Number 6. The government would confiscate all guns if they could just get away with it. That is a story I've been hearing for decades. The Democrats were coming for your guns back in 2008 when Barack Obama got elected. Except that was 13 years ago. Back then, the Democrats held the presidency, the House of Representatives, and a filibuster-proof supermajority in the Senate. Did they come for your guns then? No? Weird. The only laws on the books that enable confiscation are red flag laws. Those are passed at the state level, and they require both a red flag and red tape to decide individually if someone is no longer competent to own a firearm. The state with the most confiscations under their red flag law is actually Florida, and they can't even confiscate in most counties unless the owner agrees to it. And even then, Florida, the state that leans on red flag laws the most, sees confiscations at the rate of fewer than 1 per 10,000. There is absolutely no boogeyman going from house to house confiscating your guns. Red flag laws aren't frequently used, and they're even less frequently misused. If your argument is red flag laws, then your argument is a red herring. Number 7. This isn't any of your business. This is a quick one, because kids getting shot at schools and adults getting shot at concerts is everyone's business. Mass shootings don't have to happen to me in order for me not to want them to happen to other people. Number 8. Registration won't actually do anything. This is a great argument. If you don't understand chain of liability distribution, in most states, when a private seller sells a gun to someone with no background check that is later used in a crime, do you know who's at fault? No one. Almost every state allows private sales of firearms with no background checks. And in most states, if you leave a loaded weapon unattended on a sidewalk, the steepest punishment you'll get is the fine for littering. What registration does is take straw purchases from an honor system to an easily trackable crime. And it's not just about creating laws that would prevent the sale of firearms to people who are not mentally fit to own them. It's about creating laws that are actually smart enough to stop that from happening. Registration makes sure that the buyer and the seller are both responsible for following the law, instead of just hoping they'll be. Number 9. Hitler made people register guns. First of all, no he didn't. The Weimar Republic, which is the government that preceded Hitler, had strict gun control laws. And when the Nazis seized power, they relaxed those restrictions. The incorrect theory that you're unknowingly quoting comes from a guy named Jay Simpkin. Simpkin, who was aptly named, wrote a book in 1992. In it, he illogically compared gun restrictions in 1928 Germany to what he feared might happen in the modern-day United States. Why is that illogical? Because Hitler didn't come to power until 1932, which makes it very difficult for Hitler to have enacted gun restrictions in 1928, you Simpkins. Also, pardon me if I don't believe your faux outrage at Hitler when you're perfectly fine with Steve Bannon. If you actually cared about the safety of Jewish people, you'd investigate the terrorism at the Capitol. Number 10. Criminals won't follow the law, so what's the point? What a wonderful argument against laws. What is the point of a law? A law is to act as a deterrent. Yes, people still often break the law, but way fewer people do something when it's illegal than when it isn't. No one thinks that gun control will end 100% of gun violence. The point is to end some of it. Also, do you think the average person who shoots up a school knows how the black market works? Do you think the black market is just a store in a strip mall next to Joann's Fabrics? You don't just say, "Alexa, help me commit crimes." Because if you did, Alexa would just play songs by Leanne Rimes. It is difficult for the average person to buy illegal things without getting caught. And this would make it more difficult, which is a good thing. Number 11. The government is bound to mess this up. Maybe, but that's also true when it comes to enforcing any law. So again, unless you're advocating abolishing all laws, you can't make that argument. Number 12. Gun ownership is a right and not a privilege. You know what else is a right? A speedy trial. That's in the Sixth Amendment. Yet, look at our court systems. The Eighth Amendment specifies no cruel and unusual punishment, but many of you are fine with the death penalty. The Tenth Amendment specifies states' rights, yet there are thousands of federal laws that supersede those. How about the Seventh Amendment that specifies a right to a jury trial for any civil matter involving more than $20? Although the current standard is $75,000. And what about the Fifth Amendment? Due process. Some of you make the argument that cops are allowed to just kill people they're afraid of. Hell, even the good guy with a gun argument is in direct violation of due process. A civilian shooting someone is not due process. The reality is that the people who argue that the Second Amendment is a right and not a privilege don't actually understand any of our other rights. And if you're questioning whether or not a comedian is enough of a constitutional scholar to make this video, okay, aside from this video being full of well-researched, fully sourced arguments, I'm an honors-level American history graduate of Columbia University. I'll put my diploma up against your memes any day. Number 13. It's not just a right, it's my God-given right. No, no, and no. Even if you are a religious person, God did not write the Second Amendment. James Madison did. Also, there are only three countries in the world that have gun ownership granted as a right in the Constitution: the United States, Mexico, and Guatemala. So unless you think the rest of the entire world are a bunch of godless heathens, maybe let's keep this argument to civics. Number 14. What's the point? It'll never work. Well, gun control has worked over 100 times in other countries. If your argument is that it just can't work in America, then you are saying that Americans are either uniquely violent or stupid or both. That doesn't sound very patriotic to me. Also, again, it doesn't have to work. It just has to work better. In the 1980s, Mothers Against Drunk Driving started pushing reform. In 1985, drunk drivers accounted for 41% of all American traffic fatalities. Within 10 years, that number plummeted all the way down to 32%. Do people still die from drunk drivers? Sure. Is it way better than it used to be? Also sure. Number 15. Chicago has some of the strictest gun control, but some of the most violence in America. So here's an odd thing. The city with the highest murder rate is actually St. Louis, followed by Baltimore, Birmingham, Detroit, and Dayton, Baton Rouge, New Orleans, Kansas City, Memphis, and Cleveland. So Chicago isn't even in the top 10. Where exactly is Chicago? Number 28, just below Buffalo. But even if Chicago is number one, which it isn't, this is an argument made by people unwilling to accept the simple fact that 95% of the guns used in crime in Chicago come from outside of the city. Again, we have no checkpoints at state borders. You know how close lax gun law Indiana is to Chicago? Let's say you lived on 108th Street on Chicago's south side. Your gas station down the block is in Indiana. But do you want to know if gun laws actually work in America? The states with the least amount of gun deaths per capita, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New York, Hawaii, and Connecticut, all rank among the states with the strictest gun laws. And the states with the most gun deaths per capita, Oklahoma, Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, and Alaska, all rank among the states with the least restrictive gun laws. Quite the 10 coincidences. Number 16. But what about this completely untrue thing that I made up or repeated without fact-checking? The amount of lies that are used to distract from the gun control debate is staggering. I get dozens of them on each of my posts. For instance, this gem. It's illegal to own an airsoft gun in Canada. Weird, because it's not. It took me 11 seconds of Googling to find out that that's not even close to true. There's a new bill that is currently being debated, not yet passed, that would ban some types of airsoft guns. Specifically, ones that are designed to look and operate like conventionally regulated firearms. And that is simply not the same thing as all the ones that already exist being banned. That's like saying that because Canada is currently debating whether or not it's legal to own a lion as a house pet, you suddenly can't have cats. Number 17. It does not matter how unmatched citizens would be if the government ever came to take their guns, because soldiers and police officers simply wouldn't do that. This is a particularly weird argument, because you can't be afraid that the government is coming to take your guns and also be sure that the government is not coming to take your guns. Who is it that's going to come take your guns if not soldiers and police officers? Babs from the DMV? The reality is that guns will not protect you from a government that is hell-bent on seizing them from you. Because in this weird Rambo fantasy of yours, the people coming for the guns are soldiers. And they're a lot better trained and equipped than you are. Number 18. If the government does come for our guns, we can fight them off. Just look at Vietnam. Do you think that the terrain of Vietnam is similar to the United States? That was a war fought predominantly in jungles, not suburban strip malls. And do you think that technology has not advanced in the last 50 years? Do you think that the gap between what the military has and what civilians have is the same as it was in 1975? And even if it was, do you have any idea how many casualties there were in Vietnam? 3% of North Vietnam died in that war. 3%. That would be about 10 million Americans. Number 19. We should be focusing on mental health. The premise that these mass shootings are happening because these kids today is preposterous. Columbine was in 1999. Three of the top 10 worst mass shootings in American history happened over 30 years ago. Hell, one of them happened in 1966. The Camden shootings were in 1945. Mass shootings have been happening in America for as long as there have been guns capable of killing a large amount of people. But I do agree that mental health is a huge issue in America. So those of you against gun control, what is it that you're doing to help? Do you support trained therapists to answer mental health calls instead of police officers? Smaller class sizes? A greater investment in education? Paid leave for parents? Raising the minimum wage? These are all things proven to aid in mental health, but it is rare that the Venn diagram of people who are against gun control intersect with any of these, let alone all of them. If you truly believe that mental health is the problem for all the gun deaths in America, then why aren't you advocating doing anything about it? Number 20. There are other things to worry about. Yeah, there sure are, but that is also true for everything in the world. Yes, there are all sorts of other horrors, but this is one that we should have handled decades ago. And if you think that we should only care about the biggest horror in the world, well, then you should give a shit about climate change. Number 21. An armed society is a polite society. America has more than twice as many guns per capita as the next country, so you'd expect us to be polite as fuck. I've traveled a lot, and you know what I've never heard Americans described as? Polite. Meanwhile, look at Japan. We have more than 400 times their guns per capita, and they are pretty polite. So why the dichotomy? Someone being armed doesn't make the person they're talking to polite. It makes them scared. More importantly, people use this phrase to say that if everyone had a gun, then no one would get out of line. But that's not actually what this quote means. The quote comes from science fiction writer Robert Heinlein's book Beyond the Horizon, in a passage about how guns are a great tool to kill people weaker than you. This is actually a quote about just how bad things can get when everyone is armed. Number 22. The best thing to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. In 2011, Representative Gabby Giffords was shot in Tucson, Arizona. When the shooter stopped to reload, bystanders pounced on the guy and subdued him. Just then, someone else who had heard the gunfire came charging out of a Walgreens and almost shot one of the bystanders. Because sometimes people who mean well can be idiots. More importantly, the statistics do not bear out this argument at all. Justifiable homicides exist, like self-defense. In 2018, for each one of those, there were 34 other gun homicides and 82 gun suicides. In fact, someone is statistically twice as likely to use a gun to accidentally kill themselves than to save a life. And victims who were in possession of a gun during a crime were shot at four times the rate as people who were unarmed. It seems as though the main thing that can help a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Number 23, and my favorite. If you're not going to interpret the Second Amendment as absolute, what about the First? Well, my internet constitutional scholars, the First Amendment isn't even close to absolute, nor should it be. Time and time again, courts have correctly ruled that there are exceptions to the First Amendment. In fact, there are 9 categories of speech that are not protected by the First Amendment. Incitement, fraud, obscenity, child pornography, provoking a fight, threatening the life of the president, violations of intellectual property law, false advertising, and restricted speech based on your position in the government. 9 categories. 9. So if you want us to apply the same standards to the First Amendment as we want you to apply to the Second Amendment, cool. We already did. And now, it's your turn. Thank you for watching. Thanks for following me on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and Twitter. If you want to support my Patreon, you can at patreon.com/Steve Hofstetter. Also, I'm back on tour. If you want to see a show, I'm probably playing a city near you. Check out all of them at stevehofstetter.com and get your tickets today.
That was Steve Hostetler on the myths espoused by gun proliferation advocates. Richard Wolff is a frequent guest on Democracy Now! And other Pacifica radio programs. His own weekly radio program is carried on Pacifica station KPFK in Los Angeles. And though you never hear him on commercial television or even public radio, his scathing critiques of capitalism are more direct than Robert Reich's, another leading analyst who you don't see on MSNBC or CNN or NPR. Here he discusses inflation in its many causes and its possible remedies and, of course, its history.
We are back on the Zero Hour. I, as always, am your host, Richard R.J. Escal. We're hearing a lot about the economy in the news these days, so good thing we have an economist who joins us regularly to help us parse all of this stuff, particularly because the news media seems so bad at it. And especially we're hearing about what some people are calling, we're hearing about two things, inflation, of course, we're hearing a lot about, and then about what some people are calling the Great Walkout. I mean, there's a wave of strikes, but there are also people just quitting lousy jobs. So here to help us make sense of all of that, or at least make progress towards making sense on all of that, is our good friend Richard Wolff. Richard Wolff is, of course, an economist and economic historian. He is professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He is also a visiting professor at the New School in New York, and he is the host of Economic Update on Free Speech TV Tuesday evenings. His latest book is The Sickness is the System, and he joins us once again. So, Richard Wolff, thanks for coming back on the program.
Thank you, RJ. I'm glad to be here.
We're always glad to have you. Let's start with this, inflation. I'm seeing all sorts of panicky headlines right now, headlines that are telling me and all of us news consumers that we're in deep trouble. We haven't seen these kinds of rises in inflation for 24 years or whatever. Can you help us understand what's really going on?
Let me try. And let me be honest with you by saying it is a sad exposure of the economic literacy, if I can say that, or lack of it, that there is so much confusion. And I don't fault the public. I fault the political leaders, the media writers, who are themselves so confused that when they write about it, it only makes everything worse. And that's a comment on our whole society that has to be spoken. And nothing illustrates it better than this discussion of inflation. In most cases, when I read it, it sounds like some mysterious, awful thing that has descended upon us, like a particularly bad storm that arose out of nowhere and now blankets us with snow or drought or rain. And we shake our fingers at the heavens, but we kind of all know, gee, it's horrible, it's terrible. And then we look around for somebody to blame, but we don't really know where to look. So we take whoever shows up first and try that person or that institution. And it's a mess since we all pick different ones. So let me try to go step by step, briefly, through the basic economics of inflation that nobody can dispute because it's simply a reality that we all kind of know is there. So first, let's begin. Who determines the prices of goods and services? Literally, who puts on the quart of milk or the pound of butter or the software program or whatever else we buy, who stamps it with whatever the price is that we are expected to pay? And the answer is the employer class of the United States, that 1 or 2% of our people who are in a position to be the owner, the operator, on the board of directors or a leading executive, they're the ones who decide prices. Employees, the vast majority of us, we don't have anything to say other than either to pay what it costs or to do without. But we don't shape the prices. That's somebody else's privilege, somebody else's right. Number two, which is indisputable, what is it that leads employers to raise prices? The answer is, as every student in a business school has always been taught, the goal, the bottom line, the objective of a business executive, of an employer, is to improve the bottom line, to make more profits. Therefore, the first answer that ought to come into your mind when asking, gee, why are prices in general going up? And that's all the word inflation means. Prices in general going up. The answer is because employers see their profits improved by doing that. Because if they didn't, they wouldn't do it. This is not rocket science. I'm trying to be nice to the rocket scientists in your audience today. Okay, so then the question becomes, why would it enhance profits for corporations? They do the bulk of the business in our society, to be jacking up their prices, which indeed they are. And the answer isn't very far to find. Many corporations are making two key observations. Number one, looking at their activities over the last 18 months, many corporations have not been as successful in making profits as they had hoped and expected to be. And the reason is no mystery. Over the last 2 years, we've had the combination of an economic crash and a public health catastrophe. We've had each of those alone. We've never had the two together at the same time. And so it has hurt a lot of businesses' bottom lines. And they want to make up for what they lost over the last 2 years. And raising prices is a way to do that. Number two, many corporations notice that the government, trying to cope with the catastrophes of the last 20 years, the crash in 2000, the worst crash in 2008, and the worst of all three of them, the one we're still in, many companies are seeing that the government is pumping vast amounts of new money into our economy, which is true, that's happening. So they're saying to themselves, gee, all of this new money is sloshing around the American economy. Maybe I can pull some my way by raising the prices of what I charge for, because there's the money out there that should allow people to pay for it. Bit of a risk, I might be wrong, but it looks like the right moment. And put that together with wanting to make up for what was lost over the last 18, 24 months, you have a very powerful reason for corporations to be doing what we know they're doing, which is raising their price. Last point on this. Corporations know that for the rest of us, this is bad news. We now have to pay more for what we used to have to pay less for. That's not good. To give you an example, the inflation is now running at between 6 and 6.5% per year. Average increase in wages in this country is nowhere near that, which means that even if you are among the workers who's getting a wage increase, they're averaging around 5%, 4.5 to 5%. You're still falling behind, because even with an extra 4 or 5%, you can't afford what has gone up by 6%. I mean, that's simple arithmetic. So for the vast mass of the people, this is not good news at all. And so the employers have to be careful. They can't admit to all of us that what they're doing is raising prices to make more profits, which is the truth. They have to come up with something else, because they don't want consumers to get angry at them for doing what they are doing. So it's important to muddy the water, to come up with, gee, maybe it's the Chinese. We blame them for everything else. Maybe it's the immigrants from Latin America. Sound far-fetched? I've heard it. So you can go on and blame Mr. Biden if you're a Republican, or blame Mr. Trump if you're a Democrat. There's lots of candidates to be scapegoated here, because you don't want the honest truth to be the center of the conversation, which is, we have a profit system that tells every business owner, jack up the price of what you sell whenever you think you could get away with it. And therefore, we're living with the results of that situation, a coming together of enough conditions so that the businesses are doing what we're watching them do, and there's no mystery to it.
Well, you know, a couple thoughts, Richard Wolff. Number one, the media in this country, the press in this country, speaks about it in almost as obscure and mystical a way as the economics profession itself does, it seems to me, and that we're treated to these proclamations that inflation is this. Now, I may be oversimplifying, and I urge you to tell me if I am, but it seems to me if prices go up 6.5% annualized, okay, let's make up, is roughly that. So if inflation is 6.5%, well, inflation is what it costs to buy stuff. So buying stuff is, well, it's the workers' wages to make the stuff or deliver the stuff or service the stuff, but they're not going up 6.5%. So that doesn't explain nearly all of it. Then there's the raw material to make the stuff. If that's not going up more than 6.5% because workers' wages aren't going up that much, then that doesn't explain it either. Then there's the piece that never gets discussed in the media, which is a piece you just mentioned. Well, how much are they taking as a cut of that 6.5%? That doesn't come up at all. So it seems to me that on the simplest level, there are three numbers we should be thinking about, or three, right? I mean, it's like what people are being paid, what stuff costs, raw stuff, and then what they're charging us. It seems to me those are the three numbers. And if it's all MBS in Saudi Arabia and it's all gasoline, then okay, then we know who the bad guy is, but it's not. If it's all, the Bolivians had the audacity to elect a government that won't play ball enough with us, and so lithium's gone off, whatever it is, that, but it doesn't get presented that way, does it? It gets presented as this material. Well, Joe Biden didn't, it doesn't, we don't even know how much of that 6.5% is increased. I never see in the paper, inflation's gone up 6.5%, and of that, 1.2% is profit taking. I don't even ever see that number.
No, that's the point. You are not supposed to think about that. You're not supposed to worry about that. You're not supposed to give any ammunition to the people who say, like me, that a good part of this increase in prices is designed for and leading to a boost in profits. That just like working people want to make up for their losses over the last two years. And by the way, that's part of the struggle we're seeing in the great resignation, in the wave of strikes and so on. The businesses want to do it, but the difference is that businesses have an easy way to do it, to jack up the price. Here's another aspect of this that makes me upset as an economist. The Republicans and the conservatives and the libertarians like to blame the government pretty much for everything. So here's another one. We have an inflation, you see, because the government is increasing the money supply, which it shouldn't do. Well, this leaves the realm of bad economics and enters the more populated realm called stupidity. The government has been increasing the money supply in this country in record-breaking amounts for 20 years, during which we had no inflation. Therefore, the notion that one leads to the other would, in any person honest enough to look at the numbers, never even come up, let alone be pushed. But there's an economics of it all that should be clear to everybody. When the government increases the money supply, there's more money in the economy. That's true. But the question is, what do the corporations that set prices do when there's a lot more money sloshing around? They have a choice. They could appeal to that extra money because they want to get their hands on it by ordering more goods to be produced and sold. That's how you soak up the more money. And that's what the government wants, because if you sell more goods, you have to produce them, and that'll give people jobs. But of course, corporations, being free enterprises, are free not to sell more goods, but to try to soak up the extra money by jacking up the prices, which, hello, hello, that's what they're doing. But you can't blame the government's increase in money for something that doesn't happen when the government increases money. It only happens when corporations choose to raise the price, which no one forces them to do. And as to the fact that, gee, workers' wages go up, whenever you see an inflation, you see the wages go up after the inflation. It's workers trying to catch up. It is not the other way around. And ditto to explain it by saying the inputs they buy go up. Well, that's circular reasoning, because the reason the inputs are going up is because their inputs are going up and our outputs are their inputs. Therefore, this is a game in which the corporations are all raising prices and then blaming each other for it. Anything to avoid the profit motive, which we're taught about in school, but which is strangely missing when we analyze as urgent an economic problem as inflation.
So I want to go back, Richard Wolff, to the beginning of what you just said, because, you know, you hear this from time to time. The government has increased the money supply. Every time I've heard that, I have not had an increased money supply personally. I've never gotten an envelope from the Federal Reserve or anyone else in government with a bunch of 20s and $100 bills in it saying, here's your share of the increased money supply. It has not happened to me in my many years of living. So it seems to me, now, again, you're the economist, but it seems to me, especially this last time around as the pandemic hit, they not only increased the money supply, but they didn't even bother funneling it all through banks. They actually opened money funnels to publicly traded corporations themselves, didn't they? Yeah. And so we basically, you know, I have this mental image of corporations as well as banks now, big corporations especially, inflated, like, you know, when you make balloon animals out of, you know, just these big inflated, stretched thin things flush with money, and they're saying, oh, you know, inflation, we got to jack up your rates. And oh, by the way, stock dividends are, you know, we got to pay a bunch of stock dividends. Even if those companies like Boeing, for example, grotesquely mismanaged and murdered people, they still get inflated like a balloon animal and they still get to pay dividends. And am I on the right track here?
Absolutely. And it's important, very important what you say. Because, of course, there are N, where N is a large number. There are N ways to increase the money supply. I'm going to give you two. One is to lend a lot more money to banks, which is what the Federal Reserve does. Here's an alternative. Print the money, put it in an airplane, and announce you're flying over Philadelphia next week, and you're going to drop $10 billion in $50 bills. So you're urging people to get outside with a basket and catch as many of those bills floating down as possible. And then Tuesday you'll be in Denver and Thursday you'll be in Dallas and so forth and so on. Would that increase the money supply? Yes. Would that money then go and build up everything in the economy? Sure. Because all those people collecting the money as it flows down from the helicopter or the airplane will take that money and go to the local store. And there they will buy things that will lead the storekeeper to replenish the shelves in the store. And that will make jobs happen. You know what that's called? Trickle-up economics. Because you're giving the new money to the folks who need it most, and then it trickles up into the coffers of the corporations who produce what those people who've collected the money paid for. That's the alternative to trickle down. When you give the money to the richest amongst us, those who arguably need it least, and then wait for it to trickle down, which sometimes happens and often doesn't. But we know it'll trickle up because the mass of people have no savings, need to spend that money tomorrow for the things that they are behind on already. So we know it'll trickle up. And yet, who's the advocate for trickle-up economics? Almost nobody. The labor movement, what's left of it, a few social movements that are radical or progressive. But the establishment and the media act as though that's not an option. But of course it is. And because that option wasn't chosen, you, poor Richard RJ, never experienced the Federal Reserve sticking some money in your wallet, as none of us have, because we live in a society where those at the top organize the policy to have that remarkable quality that it lines their pockets first and foremost.
And now we have And, you know, operators are standing by for my Federal Reserve money. I just, they're waiting, but, you know. Okay. But now we have another phenomenon because we are presumably coming to the end of this protracted process of debating in Washington what I would argue is a very modest proposal, extremely modest proposal, given the gravity of the challenges we face, called Build Back Better. And which began as, you know, Bernie Sanders saying he wanted $6 trillion for it, and Joe Biden saying he wanted $3.5 trillion. Now they're at, my bet all along was $1.6 to $1.9 trillion. A lot of that would be, fast, you know, plays, you know, moving things around, pretending you're spending money. But anyway, so we're coming to the end of this process. And because it's been so protracted, now people are saying, well, inflation and government deficits, and we can't spend all this money. I did a graphic showing what Biden proposes to spend on the environmental crisis versus the military, which was ludicrous, 20 times as much for military. And so we're getting everybody saying, well, gosh, now the inflation we're seeing makes it even less possible for us to give people paid family leave like every other developed country in the world has, or, you know, you name it. And for healthcare, forget it. Medical care when people need it, no chance. Because, you know, inflation and deficits. And how should we be looking at that?
Well, I think, you answer your own question. You should be looking at it for the hypocrisy of it all, for the absurdity, but mostly because, and I say this with genuine sadness, this is a society that is determined to deny the crisis within which it functions. And, you know, my wife's a psychotherapist. I learned from her the power of the human mind when confronted with painful, difficult situations to magically get around them, at least for a while. Denial.
Did she know my mother? I think, that's a perfect description of my mother, but please, go ahead.
Yes, you know, and she explained it to me, and I just transpose it into the realm of economics. Let me say it again. We have had public health disasters in the past, not many, but doozies. For example, 100 years ago, the Spanish flu. And we have had economic crashes of our capitalist system in the 1930s and so forth. We've never had these two things happen at the same time. Never. We're now living through that. And the constant explanation that either this crisis isn't there or we're recovering magically from it is childish denial. This is not the case. Over half of the American labor force was unemployed for some period of time. Over half of them. Over the last 18 months, were unemployed, some for a few weeks, some for months. But this is a trauma. We just were told yesterday, or at least I learned it yesterday, that we have another record. 100,000 people died of overdose of drugs this last year. We've never crossed the 100,000 mark. I mean, these are staggering failures. We're 4.5% of the world's people, and we have suffered something like 16% of the world's deaths from COVID. That's called a failure. The war in Afghanistan, that was a failure. The war in Iraq, we've been defeated. I mean, I could go on, but you're looking at a network of problems that require a massive solution program. And what we get are peanuts from Mr. Biden and Republicans who want to cut the peanuts into small pieces because, you know, we can't afford a whole peanut right now. Well, when could we? When have we ever had a problem of it? They all want nothing to change. That's what Republicans want, and that's what a large number of Democrats are perfectly comfortable with, progressives excluded. And that's a recipe. That's what makes me sad. That's a recipe for the problems getting worse. Trump did nothing to change that, and the problems got worse. That helped Mr. Biden get elected, but he hasn't learned the message, so it continues to get worse. The workers at the John Deere Corporation voted to accept, after rejecting, I believe, the contract two or three times before, they won a lot. I don't want to take anything away from them. The first offer was 5% per year. They're getting 10, not a minor matter. They're getting an $8,500 signing bonus on top of that. They're not paying an extra nickel for their medical health insurance and so on. They won a lot. But it's a six-year contract with a total cap of 20%. Well, if the inflation over the next 6 years stays at the current 6%, then that will mean prices are then 36% higher than they are now, not even compounding as I should. And that's a lot more than 20%. They will be 15% lower standard of living. I mean, that's the reality. And when the Federal Reserve says, oh, don't worry, the inflation is temporary, I take a deep breath. The Federal Reserve, in addition to mastering our money, is now clairvoyant about the future, which is a stunning thing for them to attempt, since they have been wrong most of the time in the past when they predicted the future. Nobody in their right mind should take this seriously. You know, so for me as an economist, looking at the cacophony of noise here, this is a society that is desperate and trying to fake its way through a very real crisis.
And, you know, it's interesting. Desperation was one of the words that was in my head as you were talking, Richard Wolff, because we have now, you know, some people were calling it Striketober, a wave of strikes in October. My friend Mike Galk, who was on last week, was a great labor reporter, as the Payday Report. He says it's a misnomer because there's been a wave of strikes basically since the pandemic began, and certainly accelerating in the last 10, 12 months. So, and then we're seeing, besides the active labor actions, well, first of all, fascinating thing about Elk, he started tracking any labor action of 100 people or more, whereas the government, at my understanding, only tracks labor actions of 1,000 people or more. So why does it take my friend to do what we should be tracking anyway, number one? And number two, why does it take him starting a website? Now the Washington Post is drawing on his data, which is great for him and his visibility. Why doesn't the Washington, you know, the mainstream newspapers fired all their labor reporters, and the economic section of the newspapers are called the business section, right? They're not called the labor section. So excuse that mild digression and rant, but the business section, right? I mean, that to me says it all. But we now have, in addition to these strike actions, what some people are calling the Great Resignation. And Troy, get ready, because you're going to have to bleep this. But I think, you know, it should not be astonishing to anybody that, given the slightest alternative, workers will say, I don't want to work at your shitty job anymore. I mean, that should not startle anybody. And yet our business, quote unquote, media seems to be astonished by the fact that people, however meager the alternative, are so abused and underpaid in the workplace that sometimes they just, you know what, forget it. I'm going to opt out of this for a while, or try to find a job that's a little bit less immiserating. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about the quote, so-called Great Resignation, as well as the wave of strikes we've been seeing.
Well, very quickly, I think strikes and the quitting are, for me, unmistakable signs of a system in very deep trouble. You take people out of the rut they have allowed themselves to get into, and the pandemic took us out of our workplace ruts. And when you come back, you see it not with the dull eyes of everyday repetition, but having had a few months where you were at home taking care of your kids or your home. And now you see the job for what it is, and your word was perfectly appropriate here, and you can't believe you did this. You can't believe you tolerated this long. You see it afresh, and seeing it afresh, millions and millions of our fellow citizens are saying, as the old song went, take this job and shove it, because they're not going to tolerate it. And then I have a friend, a professor, Tom Lambert, who teaches in the business school and the University of Louisville in Kentucky. And he has taught me recently that there's a whole body of research that he himself has contributed to that shows that we have a bloated supervisory strata in our system. Other countries with capitalist economies like ours do not hire, do not need, and do not want these vast levels of supervising. And too many supervisors with too little to do get on the nerves of the people they supervise. And I think an awful lot of people, and Tom Lambert's right, an awful lot of people were free of that absurd over-supervision for a few weeks or months. And when they went back, they were in no mood to subordinate themselves to it again. And they walked away from crappy management supervisors who are a dead weight and a financial loss in this society and are contributing to the very difficulties of capitalism, which lead us to do everything other than ask the question, what are we doing with this excess army of supervisors?
Well, I think that's a great summary, and maybe we'll be able to talk about it more at some point. And I still think the movie Office Space, which you've probably seen, is the guy who made, the person who made that is the Eisenstein for our time. I consider that a very left-wing film. But unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. So as always, Professor Richard Wolff, thank you so much for your insights. And as always, thank you for coming on the program.
My pleasure, Richard. I look forward to our next continuation.
As do I. And we'll be right back after this. I'm Richard R.J. Eskow, and this is The Zero Hour.
That was economist and historian Richard Wolff, whose weekly radio program, Economic Notes, can be found on Pacifica station KPFK in Los Angeles. Well, you heard him here on your community radio station, WCRS-LP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRN-LP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis. I'm at a music festival once again this week, hence the background noise in my narration. But I'll be back with you again next week at this time for another edition. I hope you'll join us then. Oh, and hey, we can use volunteers at our booth at Community Festival, at the Community Festival in Goodale Park. The last weekend in June, WCRS and WGRN will have a joint booth there as last year. You can check our websites, wcrsfm.org and wgrn.org, to sign up or to donate. We need that support, too. Thanks, and I'll hope to see you again next week. Take care.
The seeds are growing. Unseen, unheard, they lie beneath the ground. Would you know until their leaves are showing that with weeds all your garden will abound? If you close your eyes, stop your ears, hold your tongue, then how can you know? For seeds you cannot see may not be there. Seeds you cannot hear may never grow. In January you've still got the choice. You can cut the weeds before they start to bud. If you leave them to grow high, they'll silence your voice. And in December you may pay with your blood. So close your eyes, stop your ears, close your mouth, take it slow. Let others take the lead and you bring up the rear. And later you can say you didn't know. Today you may earn a living wage. Tomorrow you may be on the dole. Though there's millions going hungry, you needn't disengage. For it's them, not you, that's fallen in the hole. So close your eyes, stop your ears, close your mouth, take it slow. Let others take the lead and you bring up the rear. And later you can say you didn't know. It's all right for you if you run with the pack. It's all right if you agree with all they do. If fascism is slowly climbing back, it's not here yet, so what's it got to do with you? So close your eyes, stop your ears, close your mouth, take it slow.
Red others take the lead and you bring up the rear. And later you can say you didn't know. The weeds are all around us and they're growing. It will soon be too late for the night. If you leave them on the wind that around the world is blowing, you may pay for your silence with your life. So close your eyes, stop your ears, close your mouth, but never dare. And if it happens here, they'll never come for you, because they'll know you really didn't care.